You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of After Such Knowledge, What Forgiveness? By Janine DiGiovanni, with photographs by Larry Towell. Putin's Gruesome Playbook. This is my third Vladimir Putin war. The first was the so-called Second Chechen War in 2000. I was there when the capital, Grozny, fell to Russian forces. What I remember most was the frigid, wasted landscape. I also remember the type of fear that freezes your guts to ice. I remember the excruciating sound of Putin's bombs. I remember the smell of gunfire, the constant artillery, the helicopter gunships, and the amount of sticky blood on the floor of the makeshift hospital, the former school, where I was sheltering. I remember the screams of soldiers whose limbs were amputated without the benefit of anesthetic. I remember the weariness of people sleepwalking through the streets. I remember cruelty inflicted on civilians who hid in potato shelters, wondering if that night was their last. I remember how frightened I was, and how I used the last battery of my satellite phone to report the fall of Grozny to my newspaper back in London before the device died and I was alone. I then sat up with some very young Chechen soldiers, trying to teach them rudimentary English. Through our terror and our gloom, we tried to recount bad jokes, to laugh a bit, to eat some hard bread. Outside, it was deep night, lit only by campfires. The boy soldiers told me that by morning, the Russians would enter our village and kill everyone. The tanks were already surrounding us, they said. A commander came in and ordered the boys to prepare to leave just before dawn. They would walk over the mountains to go into hiding. He advised me to come along. But because I did not have a Russian visa, having entered the country illegally through the mountains, I knew that once I was found, I would be executed as a foreign spy. "You look like my older sister," one Chechen soldier remarked as he cleaned his Kalashnikov. "You should come with us. If the Russians find you, they will just kill you." The soldier and I went for a walk as I made up my mind. We passed the school that had been converted into an ad hoc ward for those who had been injured by mines as they'd retreated from Grozny. The Russians, it turned out, had laid a trap. They told them it was safe to cross the area, a no-man's land. It turned out to have been mined. As a result, the Chechens walked into the trap and many of them blew up. Some of the soldiers, to reach the end of the field, had to step on the dead bodies to absorb the bomb blast, their winter white uniforms becoming splattered with their comrades' blood. I had been warned by a colleague I had known in Sarajevo, Miguel Gil Moreno de Mora, later killed while reporting the war in Sierra Leone, that the noise of Putin's bombs would drive me to madness. He was right. At times, I thought I was losing my grip on reality. At other times, I thought I would never get out alive. I remember finding solace in prayer, thinking that at least I could die, knowing I believed in something. I had witnessed the fall of this place. I had written about it, and I had gotten the word out before the battery of my phone died. But I did not die. I chose not to depart with the soldiers that dawn, taking my chances by staying behind. I escaped in a car driven by a man from Ingushetia. I was wearing Chechen clothes and holding a baby. I remember looking in the rearview mirror to see the Russian tanks like awful black spiders rolling into town. The troops would destroy that village, most likely killing the old women with whom I had sheltered in their cellars among the glass pickle jars. My second Putin war was Syria. By the time Putin joined that conflict in 2015, President Bashar al-Assad had already burned much of his country, but Putin added the finishing touches. He torched East Aleppo. He bombed medical facilities, killing doctors, nurses, and the wounded. He bombed schools and decimated residential areas. At the same time, Russia launched a propaganda war, recruiting troll farms and pro-Assad journalists to attack humanitarians, such as the White Helmets, the team of self-appointed first responders who dug people out from the rubble of the bombs. And now, I was in my third Putin war. The Russian troops who arrived in Bucha, however, were of a different generation of soldier than those I met in Chechnya. In Grozny, some of them had been so young that when they'd cried out, they'd yearned for their mothers. These troops could well have been their very sons, maybe their grandsons. Ironically, some were Chechens, known as Kadyrovsky, who tend to be loyal to Putin's Chechen puppet, Ramzan Kadyrov. Several Bucha survivors told me that depending on where the soldiers came from in Russia, they could be more cruel or more polite. The ones from Lake Baikal, one woman said, referring to combatants from Siberia, were the most vicious. Others contended that it was the commanders who were savage, while the younger soldiers, as a rule, were civil to the Ukrainians they encountered. Putin has developed a playbook when it comes to wars of aggression. First, long-range artillery, followed by airstrikes that level towns so as to shake the resolve of citizens, followed by on-the-ground attacks on civilians. It's no coincidence that Putin appointed as his Ukraine field commander none other than General Alexander Dvornikov, also known as the Butcher of Syria, who led Russia's operations in that country from 2015 to 2016. As in Syria, Putin's bombardments, sometimes using weapons banned by international treaties, were aimed at soft targets: hospitals, schools, shelters, food supplies. While the Russians destroyed East Aleppo with unguided missiles, cluster munitions, and thermobaric weapons, Ukrainians have not only been hit with that same arsenal, but also with thermite, which is used to melt metal. It was on Dvornikov's watch that the strategic port city of Mariupol was obliterated. By going beyond military targets and training his sights on non-combatants, Putin's calculation has been to slaughter the most vulnerable. These serial attacks on civilians in city after city suggest a blueprint, suggest Putin and Dvornikov could someday face justice as war criminals. Back to the garden. When I was reporting in Rwanda or Bosnia or the Yazidi ISIS crisis in Iraq, I was not looking at the bigger picture of genocide. In Ukraine, I am. But I also look at the individual pictures that make up the greater whole, because I cannot forget that each of the dead had a richly textured life, a history, food they loved, sports they were good at. I headed to Bucha on Victory Day, May 9th, the date that marked the celebration of the Soviets, quote, winning World War II. In Kyiv, things were tense. Rumors had been circulating that there would be a chemical attack, so people were staying home. May 9th, however, turned out to be rather quiet. When I met Irina Abramova, she was sitting outside at a splintered table, staring off into the distance. She was wearing a blue fleece, a headscarf, her wedding ring. We sat in her aunt's garden because her own house, in which she had spent her entire life, had been blown up 2 months before by a Russian grenade. Nearby was a bed of red tulips, bluebells, daisies, and strawberry plants that rose from the earth. Someone had taken the time to write the names of the plants on little sticks that were inserted in the earth. There was an ashtray with a cigarette butt in it. I asked where it had come from. She shrugged, then said she thought it might have been Ole's, her husband of 17 years, who was assassinated a few yards away from her house. Irina told me her story. She would also share aspects of her account, I later discovered, with Ukrainian prosecutors and other journalists. She told me about how she, Ole, and her elderly father, Volodymyr, had been confined to the cellar of her home, heating potatoes in an electric cooker, how they could hear fierce battles above them. "We weren't very hungry," she said, "or tired. When you're that frightened, those things don't matter." Tonelessly, Irina gave me details, showing me the pin from the grenade a soldier threw into the door of her home. She described how her father, still in the cellar, made eggs and coffee before hearing the explosion nearby. "I guess we don't have a house anymore," her father had said, spooning eggs onto a dish. She described how they had moved to another room on hands and knees, away from the windows, until another explosion burst the windows. She recalled how the soldiers came in and ordered them outside, saying, "We're not going to hurt you. Don't you see we're Russians? We're here to liberate you." They emptied the men's pockets and took their phones. "Why are you doing this to us?" Irina yelled at one young soldier. Another yelled back, "You elected a lazy government. You killed police in Maidan. You killed people in Donbass." Irina then heard another explosion and saw her house burst into flames. Her father tried to put it out with a bucket of water. She remembered how he coughed and struggled, how the soldiers laughed as he tried to drink water, how they then grabbed Ole, removed his shirt to look for telltale military tattoos or bruises from weapons, then led him outside. "They told me to stay because they didn't want me to make trouble," she said. "I realized right then they were going to kill him." Irina thinks she heard the shot. She ran outside, only to find Ole crumpled on the ground, blood spurting from his temple. "So it was an execution," she said. One soldier was near the body, calmly drinking water. Irina tried to staunch the blood spurting from Ole's temple and sensed, she said, that his heart was dying. She fell to her knees. "I began to scream to the soldier, 'Just kill me. Just kill me too.'" She said a young soldier approached her, gun cocked, and she knew from the look in his eyes he was thinking about it. She squeezed her eyes shut, awaiting the bullet. But instead, the soldier told Irina's father, "Is this your daughter, old man? Take her away." Ole died on March 5th. That was a year ago. His body stayed on the street corner until the soldiers and the tanks had gone and the dead were collected. On April 12th, Irina said goodbye to her husband and prayed as she buried him. The place where Ole died now has a cloth covering the blood, and Irina brings flowers most days to market. Her husband, whom she met one summer day at work, was a gentleman. He built scaffolding for theaters and exhibitions. They never had children, but he loved his animals. She showed me a photo of him on her phone, a young man wearing a hard hat, gently cradling a kitten. Did the soldier who fired the killing shot know when he squeezed the trigger that he was also severing ties to all the people connected to Ole, his life, his work, his community? Did he know Ole owned three cats and a dog and loved them all? Did he know that Ole's passion was motorcycling and that he had just bought an old Soviet bike as a gift to himself? "Spring is here, but it's evil," Irina told me. It will be haunted here for a very long time. This happened. Our team, of course, while gathering evidence from people like Irina Abramova, is not the only one documenting war crimes. There are forensic units on the ground examining bones and DNA. Other efforts include those of French gendarmerie, explosive technicians from Slovakia, war crimes experts from the UK, as well as a 42-member team from the International Criminal Court. There are many recently trained Ukrainian teams, too. They crouch at grave sites with jackets that say war crimes investigators, combing through bombed apartments, photographing shell casings, exhuming bodies. Already, I have filled several notebooks from my two recent trips to Ukraine. There will be several more. By the time the war ends, my team will have an archive of statements from survivors. We will have compiled some 150 testimonies from which we hope to build national and international cases. It is small. It is a start. It is painful. And it is slow. But it is a memorial, a way of remembering all of the Olis and Andris whose deaths would be otherwise unknown. I keep coming back to Elliot. After such knowledge, what forgiveness? There cannot be healing without first establishing the truth. This much I know from all the wars I've seen, from all the wounds inflicted not only when the bombs are falling, but during the reconstruction or so-called transitional justice that follows. South Africa, with its Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, managed it slightly. Rwanda, with its Gacaca courts, also tried to get to the core of what transpired during the genocide. But Bosnia, and so many other lands ravaged by war, are still racked by the ongoing lies as people try to rewrite the history of the evil that happened there. Part of the lesson of our work is that we will not let history be rewritten. We were here. We listened. We wrote down testimonies. These people existed. This happened. Like the dead buried in Father Andrew's graveyard, their memory, how they lived, how they died, will never be taken away. Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. Bonnie Raitt, the award-winning musician and activist, on life on the road, everyday heroes, and reaching enlightenment. When and where were you happiest? As a kid, my summers at camp in the Adirondacks, and as an adult when I'm on stage. What is your favorite journey, away from chaos and toxicity to more joy and peace? What is your greatest fear, that injustice, ignorance, and fascism win? What is the trait you most deplore in yourself, when I'm self-involved or insensitive to others? What is the trait you most deplore in others, arrogance and entitlement? Which talent would you most like to have, to be able to work on highly impactful documentaries? What do you consider the most overrated virtue, perfectionism? What is your idea of perfect happiness, being out in a gorgeous natural setting with time to enjoy? What is your current state of mind, grateful for what's right, pissed about what's wrong? If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? Balancing my inner and outer life. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Bringing more attention to musicians and causes that deserve it. What is your favorite occupation? The one I have, musician activist. What do you most value in your friends? Empathy. Who are your heroes in real life? Those who work all over the world in the most treacherous conditions to alleviate suffering. Jose Andres and World Central Kitchen. Doctors Without Borders. International Rescue Committee. The thousands of doctors, nurses, emergency, fire, National Guard, and recovery workers who put themselves on the line in all kinds of crises. What is your motto? It's a situation, not a problem. Which living person do you most admire? Dolores Huerta. What is your greatest extravagance? Taking personal time away from my obligations. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? My older brother would still be here. What do you most dislike about your appearance? I wish I'd listened to my mom and used sunblock more. Redhead skin and too much sun doesn't wear well. How would you like to die? In my sleep in my 90s after a great gig. What is your greatest regret? The hidden toll being on the road so much can take on your close relationships. Where would you like to live? Ireland or Scotland? If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? Maybe as someone who reaches enlightenment in their lifetime, young enough to make a real difference in others and themselves. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Bonnie Raitt.
Thank you.
Lizzo. Everything's coming up, Lizzo, and it's about damn time, by Lisa Robinson, with photographs by Campbell Addy, styled by Patty Wilson. Opening photo, Angel Eyes, Lizzo, photographed on August 4th in Los Angeles, and she's wearing a spiky black headpiece with only her beautiful eyes showing. It had been a hectic week for Lizzo. She released her second major label studio album, Special, with a five-song outdoor performance on the Today Show summer concert series in over 85-degree July heat. There were back-to-back promotional appearances in New York City, where years ago, she tells me, she had her first anxiety attack, and adds that it's always stressful when she goes to New York. Within days of the release, Special debuted at number 2 on the Billboard charts, and the single, About Damn Time, went to number 1. Now back home, somewhere in the hills of Los Angeles, she gestures to the pool and the trees and the grass outside the floor-to-ceiling glass walls and says, I like nature. She's wearing a black strapless dress from her own Yiddy shapewear line, long Chanel pearls, and Yiddy platform slides, which she kicked off as we sat and talked. Her long acrylic nails were painted a pale pink, and her hair was dark and wavy. It's mine, she said with her very distinctive, very ebullient laugh. I bought it. In the nearly 4 hours that we talked in late July in her sunny living room, Lizzo was animated, serious, passionate, and hilariously funny. The singer, songwriter, dancer, flautist, actor, and reality competition show host had just moved into her new house that week, but her belongings weren't there yet. The empty built-in shelves awaited books and numerous awards, including 3 Grammys, an NAACP award, a Soul Train award, and a BET award. The only visible personal touches amidst the custom wooden furniture were 2 bouquets of roses and an Hermes blanket on one of the sofas. We started to talk, and within the first 15 minutes, our conversation went directly to politics and women's rights, specifically the Supreme Court's overturning Roe v. Wade. Following that ruling, Lizzo donated $500,000 to Planned Parenthood and the National Network of Abortion Funds, and she had Live Nation, her tour promoter, match that with another $500,000. Political expression isn't new to Lizzo. She's been outspoken about police brutality and defunding the police, and she campaigned and voted for Joe Biden. But the fact is, she says, I don't know what they're doing. I see they're listening, but we're in a post-thoughts and prayers society. Thoughts and prayers just don't effing cut it anymore. She quickly adds, I'm not condemning this current administration. I'm just very curious as to what kind of real steps they can take. So when Lizzo asked the people at Planned Parenthood and National Network of Abortion Funds what real action she could take, the answer was money. I know plenty of people who would have died if they hadn't had that procedure, she says. And while she tells me she hasn't had a personal experience with it, she says, it shouldn't matter if I had a personal experience or knew somebody. It shouldn't matter what my opinion is. Opinions is what got us in this shit in the first place. What people think people should be doing with their bodies. These days, we don't create laws that support people having health care, never mind abortions. How about letting people have access and resources and mind their effing business? The Supreme Court has politicized law and made it a weapon against human rights, she adds. An overwhelming amount of people did not agree with what the Supreme Court did. It's about power and control. It's about white male supremacy. It's always been about white male supremacy in this country and the people who are complicit in helping uphold it, who are a lot of white women. The women who voted for Donald Trump. The facade that, America, we're all in this together. No, we're not. Black people have been dehumanized so much, especially black women. I'd like to be an optimist, but I'm a chronically disappointed optimist, she continues. The way black women have been treated in this country has made me feel very hopeless. I don't think there was a time when we were treated fairly and with respect. If I see hope in this country, it will come from the accountability of the people who have the privilege. As a fat black woman, this country has never gone forward. It stayed pretty much the same for me. Melissa Vivian Jefferson was born 34 years ago in Detroit, then moved to the Aliyev area of Houston when she was 9. She tells me it was more country than urban. It used to be all cow farms. And yes, she says, there's horses. There were kids who used to ride their horses to school. On like a half day, they'd come and show off their horse. Did she have a horse? Hell no, I don't like to get on top of things, she laughs. Nothing? Oh, well, and again that laugh. As a teenager in Houston, Lizzo was terrified to drive for years because she was pulled over so many times. The police were right behind you. They follow you all the way home. I stopped at every stop sign. I'm smiling, being pleasant. I tried to do everything right. And they follow you home. Then they veer off, and they're laughing. I've been pulled over. I've been handcuffed. They do license and registration. Okay, everything looks good. You're good to go. Ma'am, can you just step out the vehicle real quick? She grew up in a household with her mother's love for gospel music and her father listening to Elton John and Billy Joel. She was famously classically trained and maybe the most notable flautist in popular music since Jethro Tull's Ian Anderson. But, she tells me, she doesn't think she plays the flute enough in her songs. When she started to learn the flute, she recalls thinking, I want to be the best effing flute player ever. I was 12, but I wanted to take it all the way. After dropping out of the University of Houston, she meandered around the city for a while, then officially moved to Minneapolis, with a stop in between to Denver to see her family, who had moved there from Houston. It was in Minneapolis, around 2011, that she seriously pursued her music career, joining rock bands. Prince invited her to perform at his Paisley Park compound one Easter Sunday. That's when Lizzo became her stage name, a combination of her nickname Lissa and inspiration from Jay-Z's lyrical Izzo. Her big-time success comes after at least 10 years of a lot of work, struggle, and self-doubt. Her catchy, chart-topping songs have been called uplifting and positive, and most certainly danceable. Among others, her hit singles, Truth Hurts, Good as Hell, About Damn Time, will be staple items in clubs for a long time. But she's had reviewers who've called her music corny, and I ask how she deals with bad reviews. Don't get me started on people critiquing art, she says. I just ignore them. My favorite thing is, you're wrong. Your opinion wasn't fact in the first place. My lyrics are so manic sometimes. 'Cause I love you is I'm going through it. To be loved is like a panic attack. I'm doing real shit lyrically. She goes to therapy and meditates to calm her anxiety and fear and says, when something good happens to me, I'm always looking over my shoulder for something bad. The years 2008 to 2012 had a lot of dark spots and trauma. After the unexpected death of her father in 2009, she says she experienced those gut-punching moments that set you up for a fear-based life. Nobody would believe that I was happy and confident all of the time. Saying words like uplifting makes it sound saccharine and corny, but there's a rawness to my lyrics that makes it more than uplifting. Disco legend, musician-producer Nile Rodgers says, music is more than just entertainment. People are looking for nourishment to face the day, and they're doing it to a soundtrack of great songs. Lizzo is an extraordinary artist. She's made the last 3 years better with her great songs and attitude. She's proving to the world over and over again that everything is possible. And Oscar-winning songwriter, musician, producer Mark Ronson, who co-wrote Break Up Twice with Lizzo for Special, says, "I knew Lizzo was a great writer and phenomenal performer, but I wasn't aware of how deep her musicality ran. The breadth of her range and influences is awesome." And even though she sings about struggle and heartbreak, Lizzo says, "I'm not going to say anything negative in my music, because I don't want anything negative in my life. But I'll speak on things that have happened. I'll talk about hard times and how I got through it." She was bullied in school and always felt different, although she isn't sure if it was good different or bad different. While her schoolmates were getting into rap, which she loved, especially Houston rap, she was also listening to rock music, especially Radiohead. "It was a black school," she says, "mostly black and brown, Caribbean. I had Nigerian friends. They were all listening to what was on the radio, Usher, Destiny's Child, Ludacris, and I was into Radiohead's OK Computer. I kept it hidden, even when I was in a rock band, because I didn't want to be made fun of by my peers. They'd yell, 'White girl!' Also, I was wearing these flared bell-bottoms with embroidery down it, and they'd say, 'You look like a white girl. Why do you want to look like a hippie?' I wanted to be accepted so bad. Not fitting in really hurt." She adds, "My defense mechanism was humor. I became the class clown. That's a kind of perceived confidence. And I have the type of social anxiety where I get louder and funnier the more stressed I am." At first, she was intimidated to try to sing. "I grew up around gospel singers. I mean Jasmine Sullivan-type voices. My first singing voice was a rock voice in my progressive rock band when I was 19 or 20, very Mars Volta-influenced. That gave me the vocal power I've got now. It wasn't until 2015 when I realized I have a very powerful singing voice with a lot of soul." And yet, despite her early hits, 2016's Good as Hell and 2019's Juice, and more than 7.7 billion global streams of her music, Lizzo says she still feels like an underdog. "I had to prove myself with Special that I can make good music." Does she think she's more grounded than some of her peers? "I don't know how they're doing. They could be as grounded as me. Or I could be seemingly grounded. Or I could be flipping out. Look, I'm having a great time. But the things that I've experienced that I have to debunk or clarify just by simply existing, looking like me, is an indication of progress. But it's just the beginning of it. I was almost 30 when all this shit started popping up on me. I had a chance to F up as a teenager and in my 20s. I'm so glad I had a chance to grow up and then get hit with all this shit." She's close to her family. Her mother, Sherry Jefferson Johnson, went on the road early on in Lizzo's career as co-tour manager with Lizzo's brother Michael. "Her mother says it was the best time of my life. I didn't know she could sing, but she always had a very distinct, powerful voice, and I knew she was going to use her voice for something." Since her daughter's success, their relationship has become stronger. "We talk on the phone every day," her mother says. "I brought her up with good morals, so I don't worry about her. I believe that family helps keep you grounded, so you remember your true purpose." Then there is Lizzo's relationship with social media, where she engages with more than 25 million TikTok followers and almost 13 million on Instagram. Last June, after getting online backlash for including the ableist slur SP-Z in the lyrics of her song Girls, "Hold my bag, I'm a spaz," she changed the lyrics to, "Do you see this shit? Hold me back." She tells me, I'd never heard it used as a slur against disabled people. Never, ever. The music I make is in the business of feeling good and being authentic to me. Using a slur is unauthentic to me, but I did not know it was a slur. It's a word I've heard a lot, especially in rap songs, and with my black friends, and in my black circles. It means to go off, turn up. I used it as a verb, not as a noun or adjective. I used it in the way that it's used in the black community. The internet brought it to my attention, but that wouldn't have been enough to make me change something. Some comedians and TV hosts weighed in. While Trevor Noah and W. Kamau Bell commended her, Charlemagne the God disapproved of the change, and Jared Carmichael said artists shouldn't change lyrics. As for the backlash to the backlash, Lizzo says, Nina Simone changed lyrics. Is she not an artist? Language changes generationally. Nina Simone said you cannot be an artist and not reflect the times. So am I not being an artist and reflecting the times and learning, listening to people, and making a conscious change in the way we treat language and help people in the way we treat people in the future? 6 weeks after Lizzo replaced her lyric, Beyoncé changed the same word on one of her new songs. Next photo, Shine On. The About Damn Time singer dons a chrome reflective jacket emblazoned with Go Gloria in a nod to the feminist activist Gloria Steinem. Back in August 2021, 2 days after Rumors, her collaboration with Cardi B, was released, Lizzo went on Instagram Live, crying, responding to what she said was a racist, fat-phobic comment directed at her online. I ask why she bothers to look at these things. She says sometimes comments float to the top of her post, and she won't say specifically what the insult was because then people will know what really hurt me. But, she adds, people have been calling me fat my entire life. But that was the first time seeing an insult of how I looked, who I am, and my music wrapped into one, and it really hurt me. And if one person says it, then another person says it. It multiplies like an effing virus. If enough people on the internet start echoing sentiments about you, it becomes part of your public persona, and it's out of your control. She had been sitting in hair and makeup, really upset about the insult, about to tape Watch Out for the Big Girls, her Emmy-winning competition show that found dancers to perform with her on tour, and was overthinking it. There's been so many times I've been in glam where I've been sad about something, either a romantic thing or somebody passed away, or something in the news, and I'd get emotional, and I'd say, I've got to take a break because I'm going to cry and F up the makeup. I had to go and do my job, so I went to the bathroom to cry about it. Then I went online, because once I learn how to express myself, I need to tell that person how I really feel. I know I'm not the only person who experiences extreme negativity thrown at them from the internet. There are people in high school right now who have a whole high school talking about them, and they don't know how they're going to get through it. So if they can see me get through it on the level and the scale I'm experiencing it, maybe they'll think they can get through it too. Did it make her feel better? Hell yeah, it made me feel better. F them. This past August, she went teary-eyed on TikTok, watching a young black girl dance to her number one single, About Damn Time, and said, this is why I do what I do. This is my Grammy. You know what really gets me, she continues. I saw a tweet, say what you want about Lizzo. And I was like, what are people saying? I saw a picture of me laughing, and someone said she seems to have a lot of fun with her fans. Yeah, I do have fun. Because if I'm not having fun right now, When am I going to be able to enjoy having a hot rockin' bod, being young, beautiful, and rich? She laughs. I don't ask how rich, but I venture that she can pay her bills. I can pay my bills. I can pay my family's bills. What a blessing. When I literally could not afford a $5 Jimmy John sandwich, I couldn't afford to buy a $2 frozen pizza. I'd have to get quarters from strangers for gas money. Hell yeah, I'm having fun. I'm celebrating every MFing person's birthday who's around me. I'm going hard. I'm working hard. And I'm resting hard. When I ask if she tires of all the body positivity discourse, she says no. She knew what she signed up for. She knew what she was getting into. Does she feel that she's been put into a box she can't get out of? I can't fit into a box, she laughs. You mean if I lost weight, what would happen? Is my music and my weight so intrinsically connected that if I were to lose weight, I'd lose fans or lose validity? I don't care. I lead a very healthy lifestyle, mentally, spiritually. I try to keep everything I put in my body super clean. Health is something I prioritize, wherever that leads me physically. Like veganism, people were like, "You're a vegan? What, are you deep frying the lettuce?" I'm not a vegan to lose weight. I just feel better when I eat plants. But, she admits, just when you think you've got it all figured out, it changes again. I eat when I'm stressed out, sometimes to the point where I didn't realize how much I ate. Anything can be harmful, but it comforts me in a way. It sucks that we associate weight gain with the negative thing that causes it. It's mixing this beautiful thing that's food and nourishing ourselves with it, but it's the stress that's the bad thing, not the 20 pounds. I feel very lucky because I don't feel that weight gain is bad anymore, nor is weight loss. It's neutral, and food is fun. I love eating, and I have a chef now, and I'm not thinking about it. I had a brownie last night. What about people who feel that performing in skimpy ensembles adds to the sexualization of women? When it's sexual, it's mine, she says. When it's sexualized, someone is doing it to me or taking it from me. Black women are hypersexualized all the time and masculinized simultaneously because of the structure of racism. If you're thinner and lighter, or your features are narrow, you're closer to being a woman. Lizzo says her onstage costumes are dance leotards, which she decided to wear in 2014 because she was dancing and had dancers on stage with her. After Beyoncé's Single Ladies, it seemed like it became the industry standard for everyone, she says. I wanted to be like a dancer, and also it was kind of political and feminist in my eyes to have me, a full-figured dancer, wearing leotards, showing and celebrating curves, and being Olympian in strength, endurance, and flexibility. She refers to the scantily clad Josephine Baker and her banana skirts in the 1920s and says, "Movements have to evolve generationally. The culture changes. You can't have a movement in 1920 be the same thing as it is in the 2020s. We have to match the rebellion. The rebellion isn't even the same." In September 2021, she did a TED Talk on twerking, referencing the West African Mapuka dance, Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith, and tells me, "I think it deserved being intellectualized. It deserved to have a classical etymology. It needed an origin story. It's a black woman thing. It was almost printed in our DNA. It disappeared and resurfaced in the 1920s, then disappeared and resurfaced in the 1980s. It's an almost inexplicable phenomenon. Remember Sir Mix-a-Lot's song, 1992's Baby Got Back, I Like Big Butts and I Cannot Lie? To black women, that's a compliment. But now everybody wants a big butt. She mentions Beyoncé's Bootylicious and says, I can't even put into words what Beyoncé did for so many people. She was the beginning of black women celebrating their curves. Although she was on the smaller end of the spectrum, but she was our only representation. It's wild to see the popularization of big butts, and I don't even think this generation understands it. There's kids stuffing pillowcases in their butt, mimicking black women, and don't even realize the implications of that. Lizzo tells me she could do a TED talk just on the word bitch, which she uses frequently in her music. When I sing I'm 100% that bitch in Truth Hurts, nobody ever finishes the sentence. I'm 100% that bitch even when I'm crying crazy. I've got boy problems. That's the human in me. It's the crying crazy that's important. Someone can make you think you didn't hold yourself with respect. So when I say I'm 100% that bitch, it's like an affirmation. It's a reminder of who you are. I wrote that song for people to sing it and do it for themselves. Do you remember when Missy Elliott and DeBrat took control over that word and empowered it? It's a colloquialism now, a shout out to black women. Her mother, who brought Lizzo up in a religious home, says when she started out, she didn't use profanity at all. She got the family together, took us to a therapy session, and explained to us that she would be using profanity in her songs. She prepared us for it. She was always a free spirit and didn't like clothes, so that was not a surprise at all. She is doing what she loves to do, making her own decisions and really helping people along the way. I'm so proud of her. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.